Hi, this is Alina and Megan, and you're listening to Move Your Brain, Move Your Body podcast, where we dive into all things health, wellness, and fitness.
We are two certified athletic trainers, personal trainers, and nutrition coaches who met and graduated together from the University of Arkansas. And we want to do this podcast to spread our joy about treating our bodies well through nutrition, exercise, and knowledge. Today on the podcast, we welcome physical therapist, Dr. Rich Severin. Dr. Severin is a board-certified cardiovascular and pulmonary clinical specialist. Currently, he is finishing a PhD in rehabilitation science at the University of Illinois at Chicago with a focus on cardiorespiratory physiology and obesity. His dissertation project is investigating the role of respiratory muscle performance in obese patients undergoing weight loss surgery. Dr. Severin serves as a clinical faculty in the Department of Physical Therapy at the University of Illinois at Chicago and is the coordinator of the Bariatric Surgery Rehabilitation Program at UI Health. He is also a part-time clinical assistant professor in the Hybrid Doctor of Physical Therapy program at Baylor University. So I just told you guys, Dr. Severin is actually one of my professors from Baylor, and his classes have been some of the most interesting that I've taken at Baylor, and he is an amazing professor, super passionate about his profession. So we really look forward to sharing this with you guys. All right, so today on the podcast, we welcome Dr. Rich Severin. Welcome, Dr. Severin. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Megan and Alina.
Of course. Yeah. So please tell us just a little bit about yourself.
So my name is Rich Severin. I am a faculty member both at Baylor University and at the University of Illinois at Chicago, where I am finishing a PhD focusing on cardiorespiratory physiology, specifically looking at how breathing, the breathing muscles are affected in patients with class two obesity and how that changes some of their physiological responses to exercise. Needless to say, I was pretty busy this past year of COVID because I'm a target population. And I teach cardiopulm at both universities. I am a cardiopulmonary clinical specialist and a bunch of other things. So, but yeah, and I'm based in Chicago.
Awesome. Yes. So with that, so Dr. Severin is actually one of my professors at Baylor. And I actually didn't know exactly, I knew kind of an idea of what your research is, but I'm actually super curious as to like what exactly you're doing as far as like the study that you're doing as far as how the breathing muscles are affected you're finding.
Yeah. So we have a few studies kind of underway as part of this dissertation project. And one I could talk about now because we published some of the aims, but the overarching, I guess, question we're trying to answer that dyspnea or shortness of breath is probably one of the leading symptoms experienced by people with obesity. You know, and it's supported by the literature, supported by anyone who's worked in obesity medicine. I coordinate a bariatric rehabilitation clinic. You know, we even just asking our patients, we also have objective data, a dyspnea scale that we serially assess if it's an issue. However, and this is also supported by the research and also supported by just anyone who's worked in obesity and anyone who's has obesity, that they're often labeled as having asthma. Obesity, as you will learn in our pulmonary unit, there is an increased incidence of asthma. There are some inflammatory changes that we think may happen to the lungs and affect hyperreactivity in the lungs and all that stuff. However, asthma in a lot of obese patients is diagnosed clinically, meaning that they don't actually do PFTs. They don't do lung function tests. And that's supported in the literature that obese patients are often labeled as asthmatics, sometimes prescribed medications for asthma. Yet, you know, depending on different perspectives, some people say you can get by with a clinical diagnosis and you don't actually have to do spirometry or PFT. But in my view, that's, you know, I'm an asthmatic myself. I've been asthmatic since I was a young kid. And I mean, I had pulmonary function testing and, you know, saw a pulmonologist. And I think, yeah, it's important that if we're, because you're prescribing someone medication, you may not necessarily need it and may not get to the underlying issue. So my thought, what we're looking at is that it's actually the breathing muscles or the demands of breathing, the work of breathing imposed, and the changes that occur with obesity that are explaining the dyspnea that they experience primarily, or at least more than maybe the lungs, or at least it's an underappreciated area. And the great thing about, as you'll soon learn, there's ways to assess that with reliable and valid tools. I actually have some of them. I have basically like a mad scientist department. And there's ways to train them that are really easy, non-pharmacological, non-invasive, highly effective. So that's the overarching view. So we're doing a lot of stuff that like a lot of PTs don't do. Like I do ultrasound. So I image a diaphragm to see contractility changes. We do expired gases. So we're looking at, you know, VO2 max, but also the ventilatory efficiency. So how efficiently are they breathing? And then I don't want to give away too much because it's a pretty novel mechanism, but looking at how acute fatigue may be a bigger factor in this patient. So there's something that hasn't been reported before. So
interesting.
Yeah. That is raise some eyebrows at CSM, but yeah.
That is super cool. Wow. So are we hypothesizing that just the diaphragm has a difficult time just descending just because of the mass?
It's a combination of things. So and if you want to, because you guys, you know, are able to look at ahead in the lectures and stuff, because I put them on for everybody, but they actually, we wrote about this in, it's like a textbook chapter we wrote, but there's two things that occurred in obese patients in a very general sense. So your breathing muscles work against, primarily the work of breathing is dictated by airway resistance and the lung chest wall compliance. Mm-hmm. So when we breathe in and out at the end, and stop me if I'm getting too deep into the physiology. I'm not sure the audience is. Yeah. So at the end of normal breathing, we get to a volume called the functional residual capacity, which is people think of like residual capacity, think of residual volume. It's a little bit different. That's what's in the lungs after a forced expiration. That's not what we're talking about. The functional residual capacity is the volume of air in your lungs after a normal breath, essentially. So, but that's the volume that always remains in the lungs after a tidal breath. Now, in obese patients, that volume decreases. Okay, and that's because of this restrictive-like defect in the lungs that we see due to changes in lung chest wall recoil forces. So the lungs, because of the elastin and because of the surface tension that, you know, comprise the structural elements of the lungs, they have a tendency to want to pull in on themselves. That's like where they inherently kind of want to go. If you can think of your chest wall kind of has an inherent pull wanting to pull out, right? Pulling out that way, or recoil. And obviously it keeps the lungs inflated, all the pleural pressures, but that those forces are in balance with each other. What happens with obesity is because of the truncal fat that surrounds the chest, the outward pull is decreased. So the net pull inwards is higher. Once that happens, that causes the volume in the lungs to decrease. When the volume or the FRC or functional residual capacity decreases, it also decreases the caliper size of the airways themselves, get a little bit smaller because there's less air pressure keeping them open. So the airway resistance goes up. So it's harder to breathe because the airway resistance is higher. And there's obviously that truncal fat. And like you mentioned pretty aptly, that there is a length tension shift in the breathing muscles, the diaphragm contracts downwards. Mm-hmm. You have a lot of truncal fat, less, there's more stuff in the way. So it's kind of at a force disadvantage. So it's a bit of a double whammy. Yeah. And yeah, so higher demands and then potentially lower force generating capacity, which is, you know, for most people, you know, the demands of breathing are really negligible. We're actually very efficient at breathing and everyone's breathing looks a little bit different. That's totally cool. And yeah, like it's, you know, for example, most people, and you guys will actually do this test in lab, you'll be able to generate about 100 or so centimeters of water of pressure. A tidal breath for most people, it's going to be about 5 to 10 centimeters of water. We're talking about 10%, you know, less than 10% of what our peak demands are. Energy demands are about 1 to 3, you know, percent of our energy expenditure. Again, we're very, very efficient. In an obese patient, that can increase like 3 to 4-fold sometimes, the energy demands and their ability to generate force. So it's something that we observe like across the average, their peak pressures are a little, they can peak force output they have is lower and they likely have higher demands. So when they start exercising and those demands of breathing go up, they may not have the envelope of function or reserve to tolerate that. So, and we also think that some of these effects on breathing performance translate into other aspects of life, you know, sleep quality, looking at different things with obesity. So, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. And that's such a bummer too, because like what they need is to move. Yeah. So it makes it difficult to do that, but hopefully you solve all the problems. So it sounds like you're on your way.
You brought up a good point. So the reason kind of what sparked my interest is one of the leading barriers for patients who are obese to exercise is the dyspnea, the shortness of breath they experience with exercise. And if we're prescribing them, you know, asthma medications, you know, that may not get to the root of what's their problem, because that's, they don't have like true asthma. You know, shortness of breath can be caused by a lot of different things, not always asthma. That may continue and may persistently be a barrier. Whereas if we had assessed those muscles, and maybe you observe, maybe their breathing muscles are fine, they actually do have asthma. Okay, fine. But there's probably a subsegment where that's not the case, and that we could train those breathing muscles and make them a little bit more stronger and more efficient. And that may encourage them, like you said, to move more, which will kind of help with everything. So,
yeah.
That's kind of interesting. As you were talking about that, I was just thinking about how internal obliques and like TAs can, IOs and TAs can really help with moving the rib cage to help pull the diaphragm in a better position. So I'm kind of wondering, have you looked at that? If so, I would expect it to be harder for somebody who's obese, but if you found anything or if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes breathing assessments and a lot of clinical practice can get a little bit too into the weeds on things that may not be as important, you know, and breathing is something almost I view it as like gait. And yeah. I view dyspnea a lot like pain, that everyone's gait may look a little bit different. There's probably bandwidths of normal. And, you know, there's things that we can focus on and control versus things that like are going to kind of run normally. But one thing we have looked at is during exercise, like putting them in a flexed position to move the abdominal contents out of the way. So like, you know, basically that abdominal, those larger or distended abdominal contents that kind of block that descent of the diaphragm, you know, by standing forward, it kind of shifts that stuff anteriorly, gives a little bit more room. Something that we've looked at potentially or have thought about, like maybe as a way to position patients on like for doing, you know, continuous exercise. So
yeah, that's super interesting. Things that like I've never even thought about because I've never dealt with that population on a large scale, at least. So you're obviously not a typical physical therapist.
In this country.
In this country. So you're not a typical PT in this country. So we just kind of wanted to segue a little bit into where, so you're really involved with student physical therapists and the APTA just in general, and advocacy for the profession. So we're both just curious, like where you think physical therapy is going, especially with how you're advocating for us to be more proactive with, you know, just people's being like, for example, with hypertension, like screening for hypertension or other problems that could be foreseen before they become a bigger problem.
Yeah. So there's two different questions there. It's where, you know, where do I see the profession going and where would I like it to go? You know, and because, you know, but I think your question is like, where would I like it to go? Right.
Yes,
to
a certain that's
degree.
Better.
And I think we are moving in this direction to a degree. There's been more people besides just me talking about this, about getting into the health promotion aspect of healthcare. You know, we've talked about it. Obviously, in my course, I've talked about it probably ad nauseum now in different papers, podcasts, position statements about, you know, if we look at the populations that come into our clinics, you know, even outpatient, you know, they are primarily, you know, we see inactivity, we see hypertension, we see obesity, we see a lot of these things. Remember, while we're treating them for their back pain, treating them for their arthritis, I can't cut and dry see a patient for obesity. Like, that's not a referring diagnosis for a PT. It's not. I can't see a patient for, you know, for weight loss. I can't see a patient for just blood pressure. There's ways for me to see that then, you know, I can see them for the primary condition and talk them and counsel them for those things. There's also a broader, you know, physical deconditioning code, which a lot of people in outpatient cardiopulm physical therapy use. They're not attached to a standalone cardiac or pulmonary rehab facility. But I'd like to see PTs getting back more involved in that. And I say getting back because I've talked to you guys about this before, but cardiopulm was our first specialty in the United States. I mean, in fact, my professor at the University of Miami, Merrill Cohen, was one of the first three specialists in PT practice with her and Scott Orrin and Linda Crane. And throughout our history, managing ventilators was a big part, kind of where we came onto the scene during the polio epidemic. You know, it's a bigger part of the profession internationally. There aren't cardiac or pulmonary rehab professionals like there are here, you know, exercise physiologists or exercise nurses. It's run by PT. And, you know, we've moved away from it, you know, into other areas. But yeah, just, you know, finding ways to get involved in prevention maybe we won't go back to the traditional outpatient cardiopulmonary rehab, but at least having that more integrated within our profession, and that where hypertension is something that, you know, a PT is not just screening for and talking to about a patient, but potentially intervening, you know, through the services we already provide. You know, exercises for patients with below a certain risk level, it's probably one of the best interventions, even if people's at a higher risk, probably one of the better interventions. And we're the only profession that can take, so I think we covered this in your hypertension lecture, but there's a good prognosis if someone demonstrates post-exercise hypotension that they're likely to respond well to exercise training to manage their blood pressure. Mm-hmm. As of right now, we are the only profession that can serially do that in every patient. Physicians can't do it. And I'm talking like point of service. Like we could do it for every patient if we wanted to. And the American College of Cardiology, the AHA, put out stuff since 2017, trying to get people enrolled in the medical system and engaged in lifestyle intervention programs. But there isn't the infrastructure in place to do that. And it's because PTs right now, in my opinion, because if PTs would be able to and would be willing to see these patients for hypertension management, the infrastructure is here. It's all the thousands of PT clinics around the country. But a very long-winded answer, getting involved in blood pressure management, disease prevention.
I mean, you've lectured because you are my professor, not just lecture on a soapbox, but you told us like it's super important and valuable for PTs to be able to screen like all of our patients for blood pressure, just because, I mean, people usually don't know that their blood pressure is high and it can be super deadly. But just off of what you just said, so not only can we screen people for it, but what if, for example, like their physician were to, you know, take their blood pressure, because that's what physicians typically do. And that's where people find out they have high blood pressure, or at least I think it is. Could they not have programs where physical therapy was working with those patients you can monitor like their response over time? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Not only just smart and helpful for society, but also a good market. And I'm kind of wondering why that hasn't been tapped into.
I've wondered about that for a long time. Client comes in, they go to the doctor, they get told they have high blood pressure. They should be referred out, not just like here's meds. They should be referred out to exercise, coaching, physical therapy, whatever they need. All those people that work in those professions can help them, but instead they have to decide that on their own. So that's, I think, a little bit about our healthcare system.
So there's a couple things to unpack there about it too. So it's one, like family care providers, like they probably have the most like understaffed clinical service in all of medicine. So their time to be able to communicate with patients, which is even more speaks to what your point, like you should have services there, right? You know, an integrated clinic where you've got physicians, PTs, dietitians, you know, health psychologists, pharmacists there. Unfortunately, you know, I think there is some apprehension, and this is, I think our profession actually has some transgressions we need to unpack a little bit too, you know, because while, you know, maybe these clinics aren't bringing in PTs, there's a belief, and I get where it comes from, against physician-owned PT practice, or what we call POPs, where you have, you know, a hierarchical model where the physician oversees the clinic, and there's other disciplines there. And people view it as, well, it's like you're kind of subservient to another profession or an autonomous profession. And it's like, well, if you view it that way, but there's a way to be collaborative. Like I work in an interdisciplinary clinic now. I'm a standalone kind of from the PT side within bariatrics. And we've got representatives from every other department. We're a hospital-based system, so it's a little bit different than an outpatient clinic. But I think some of the failure is, again, time constraints, those clinics not being there. But I also think we need to maybe, I don't say come to a compromise, but realize, hey, like these integrative models aren't the worst thing. And there's a way to operate that it's like, you know, every profession is kind of on an equal footing. You just got the right partner. I agree with you. That's the best way to do it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, collaboration is what our medicine should be doing anyway. Take care of the patient, at least in my opinion. So we talked a little bit about your research, but is there any interesting up-and-coming research that you just are following currently? You'd mentioned in class something, if you don't have anything else for me, but...
Yeah. Was there, are you talking about BFR?
Yeah. Yeah, tell us about that. That was cool.
BFR is pretty awesome. So I'm probably not the best person to talk about it, but I've been following it pretty closely. I'm not a BFR researcher, but I've been following it pretty closely since about 2015, maybe a little bit earlier, in like late 2014. And now it's, you know, I remember talking about it. This is going to be huge. And at that time, it was just looking at, you know, I think they were the first studies looking at preserving and recovering muscle mass in patients following an ACL injury. So, you know, people, long-term issue after orthopedic surgery, especially ACL, is the atrophy that happens to the quadriceps, you know, hands with all the fine muscles. And, you know, that was showing pretty conclusively as a way to help build that or even preserve some of the loss of that mass. My area of interest, and I think it's kind of what you're alluding to, is looking at how we know muscle mass and muscle tissue is metabolically active, you know, just like every other tissue in our body. It also secretes cytokines itself, called myokines, which have, you know, ubiquitous effects throughout the body. They're generally pretty good for our health. We know there are some populations where body composition is a big problem and probably contributes to some of their, you know, cardiometabolic disease risk. So we're thinking patients with obesity, patients with diabetes, but also patients with heart failure, COPD, where muscle mass is really important. Now, the concern obviously is BFR, like, has really just been looked at in healthy populations. And obviously you're constricting blood flow. There's also some concerns about the barrow, like the pressure reflex that occurs afterwards. But from what has been out, what's been published now suggests that, you know, that aggressive blood pressure response we see following BFR can be attenuated if we do like intermittent cuffs on and on throughout the workout, as well as over time that reflex kind of gets like also habituated a bit. So there's ways to do it safely. I think that is going to be another big thing, extending out into probably first in geriatric populations where it's been looked at, and then probably patients with obesity and with COPD, who are a population that's known, especially COPD, where losing muscle mass is really bad for the long-term prognosis. But yeah, I'm a fan of it. I think it's like, it's the frontiers of medicine, not just rehabilitation. And it's pretty cool. The physiology behind it, it's fascinating. It really opens the eye to how hypertrophy or muscle hypertrophy isn't just like pure mechanical loading of tissue. That's a necessary stimulus, but the metabolic environment that the cells are kind of bathed within is also a pretty big determinant as well too. So yeah.
I remember, and I actually could have just completely misremembered this in class, but did you mention something about there was research emerging with diabetics and it influencing insulin sensitivity potentially, theoretically, or?
I don't know if it was in diabetics. Yeah. I know it's been looked at in pre-hypertensives, and that I know it's been shown to improve endothelial function, which by kind of connection probably would improve insulin or not uptake at least. Mm-hmm. The thing we did talk about though, your muscles are your sink basically for glucose. That's where it's uptaken to eventually. So if we have a bigger sink and healthier blood vessels, like that's probably a good thing. I think, I don't know if it's been done in diabetics yet, just because of the big concern, even though it's probably not that much of a concern, if it's done safely, the right person, is the clotting issue. And diabetics have a higher risk for blood clots. So I think the people who are in this space, I think, are pretty bright. Brad Schoenfeld's in there as well. Nick Rolnick, a few. Jeremy Linecki as well. They're really bright people. I think there's been a gradual, Johnny Owens, another guy in there. They've been very intentional with the populations they're starting with because, yeah, a lot of people when it first came out and they started talking about transitioning to patients with chronic diseases, it's like, people are like, what are you, you're going to do what? Yeah. And like how, but then again, 50 years ago, people would say, if you had a heart attack, well, you don't need to exercise, you just need to rest. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, you need to recover, but cardiac rehab was something completely unheard of. Same thing with heart failure. When I had graduated PT school, heart failure was not a reimbursable diagnosis for cardiac rehab, which is like, now 8 years later, it's like, how was that ever, you know, but just like, I think we operate from a position of caution, and maybe sometimes overly cautious in medicine, but, you know, it's for the safety of people, but sometimes I think we could be a little too overly cautious.
Yeah. Or maybe lawsuits. Like they're worried about lawsuits more than possibly. Anything. Yeah. Did you have a question, Alina?
No, it's just very interesting. The conversation's very interesting. I'm finding just it complements with some of the things that I've studied and things that I've seen with, you know, patients. Well, I want to ask you what your ultimate goal is.
Take over the world. No, but my ultimate goal personally or professionally? Or
Both. That's a broad question. Personally Both. And professionally. How about that?
Well, be a billionaire. I don't know. Maybe that's a good personal goal, but not going to be a billionaire
like,
PT.
I was like, you're a PT. Yeah. Although, if you find some sort of like solution to something.
I've got a few inventions working on, but I mean, we'll disclose those. But
you can disclose those. That's fine.
Yeah. But that is good advice to people. Like, you know, there is money to be had as a PT in product development and stuff like that, consulting. But professionally, you know, I don't know if you guys have saw this. I am running for president of the APTA Academy of Cardiovascular and Pulmonary Physical Therapy. So that should open up in October, November. So that's a very immediate goal. But yeah, I'd probably have bigger or greater influence within APTA. I've done some stuff within APTA. It's now to take that next step into higher level leadership positions within APTA. And then, you know, we've got some pretty exciting projects to get some funding on. So I've have great mentorship here at UIC and people have gotten big time grants. So Shane Phillips is my PhD advisor. So we're looking at some R-level awards after I finish. So, but yeah, those are probably the two big ones, you know, in the immediate. And then, oh yeah, defending a dissertation, that's probably a big one. So that's probably, but I'd say, yeah, you know, I'd like to lead some organizations. The Cardiopulmonary Academy is going to be hopefully the first one that I'm leading. And then we'll see where it goes from there. I had an, you know, experience this past year as a delegate in the House of Delegates and just seeing how our professional organization is kind of run at a very close kind of granular level. That's kind of, you know, piqued my interest in the leadership within our national organization and even internationally. You know, it's something that I'd like to see more PTs, you know, even involved within the World Congress or Confederation or World Physio now. That's something I always felt was kind of odd that we've got obviously members of APTA and people are active within APTA. But did you know there's a North American and Caribbean like chapter of the World Confederation for PT?
No. And I also wanted to ask based on that, because I don't know this, are we like, is America a part of like a worldwide physiotherapy, like, or are we just our own thing and don't really interact with people?
It's, well, there's interaction.
Is it good interaction?
There's positive interaction. And I think both organizations, APTA, the Australians, the British, you know, CSP, Chartered Society of Physiotherapy, like we're pretty big organizations by ourselves, like that, you know, and I think in a lot of more developing countries where PT and I, you know, spent time in Kenya, I have colleagues all around the world that they're really trying to build up their professional organizations and getting involved and plugged into WCPT or World Physio is a good way to kind of get stuff going. But we're so established that I think, you know, APTA is like, well, kind of our own sovereign state here. Like, what's the point? But I think there's a bigger push now, given what we saw with COVID and how really important it is that we're sharing data, we're sharing position statements and knowledge and resources, and using maybe the WCPT as that vehicle for disseminating good information to areas where PT is still kind of a burgeoning profession. You know, an area of passion and interest of mine is kind of sub-Saharan Africa. I've got a lot of really good friends from there. And I mean, there are countries where there are, you know, maybe fifth, I think two PT schools, you know, some countries in there have maybe like 15 total PTs for the whole country. Like it's, we view like our problems here of people who don't know what PTs are. Like in some countries, like there might not even be PTs. Yet they have injuries, they have movement, you know, issues and, you know, all kinds of other things that PTs can help, you know, help serve. So I think it's important to have a national organization that is, or international organization that helps, you know, bring the best from everywhere to help make everywhere, you know, on the same level.
Fostering other countries. Yeah, that's awesome. This is a complete tangent, but I was going to ask you earlier and I forgot. So going back to the cardiopulmonary specialty and how that was the first specialty, like how did we get away from it? Like what was the genesis for that? Just out of curiosity.
Yeah. So the question you asked about why did we move away from cardiovascular and pulmonary? Now there's a couple, like everything, there's multiple forces at play here. So one being a big one was reimbursement for cardiac rehab, kind of declining. So it's harder to staff PTs, given the salaries that we kind of command now versus hiring, you know, an EP or a tech. And then just, I think, our interest as a profession. We kind of leaned more into orthopedics, into neurological rehabilitation. And I think that kind of led to it. There's other reasons too, but those are probably the big ones. Reimbursement and where we just put our emphasis as a profession. We put more of our eggs in orthopedic and neurological basket. But yeah, it is surprising just given that, like, if you look historically, the roles PTs have had, you know, the polio pandemic, and then looking internationally, that's probably also a big thing, you know, the emergence of respiratory therapists. Mm-hmm. So in the hospital, and we have a whole separate profession that does not exist in other countries that manages mechanical ventilators, right? Like, that's not a thing in other places. So those things, I think, in combination, and then with AACDPR acquiring ACLS training for people to be a, you know, certified cardiac rehab facility, it's really hard for PTs to get ACL certified because you don't get anything in your training on how to put in, you know, an IV or medications or stuff like that. Anyone who's an outpatient, like, I got trained in it as a resident, even how to put in an IV, but, you know, with the understanding that if we were ever in a code, like, I'm not going to be the one putting in the IV. It's like I do every day. So, but yeah, those are probably the big things that have led to that. But I think with COVID, I mean, I think with the effects on the cardiovascular and obviously the pulmonary system of these patients, it's kind of rekindled some interest in, like, you know, hey, why did we used to do this? And it's like, yeah, we did. I think that's probably why.
Yeah. And then even just with, I mean, I think the model of having more prevention or just like the wellness model even is like, hopefully, I mean, I want to practice that way as a physical therapist. And I think that helping control blood pressure and just working with more cardiopulm-esque situations is indicated there too.
Yeah.
Super interesting.
Yeah. And the APTA has created a special council on health promotion and wellness too. So I think, you know, even before COVID, so I think we're moving back in, I think, the right direction. I think the papers and stuff that, you know, Dr. Sabai and I have written and some colleagues have really helped. We put there pretty bluntly about, like, the professional duty for these things and where we could go. And we've got a paper that's accepted with revisions coming out in PTJ soon to talk about some of these things too. And as a direction kind of for the next century of our profession. So, yeah.
Cool. That's awesome. Yeah. We'll be looking for that. And cool. When do you defend?
That's the other $1 million question. So
you don't know.
I had there not been COVID, I probably would have defended last year. So with the unpredictability of the situation, I try not to be too flagging the ground. This one's going to be, but if there isn't another worldwide shutdown, probably somewhere in January or February. So yeah.
Cool.
Hopefully no more shutdowns.
Yeah, that'd not be good. That'd be good.
Where can people find you?
So people can find me on social media. I've got fortunate to have the same account username across Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. It's a little weird because someone took PT Reviewer, just PT, or, you know, Reviewer. And on Instagram, it's PT _Reviewer. If someone inexplicably took it, doesn't use it, I don't know how I can just get a hold of that account. I kind of want it because it's the one that I just don't have. And I also have the YouTube channel, which is really just like videos for my students and then some technique stuff up there, but primarily on the social media platforms.
Awesome. We ask our guests a special question at the end, and we ask every guest. So, and I think you'll like this question just based on everything you do and what you study. What do you do every day, but maybe not every day, it could be sometimes every other day, to move your brain and move your body?
To move my brain, combination of things. So I do meditation or meditative practice daily, either if it's just prayer or like actual just like sitting and kind of going through different techniques and stuff I've learned. And I mean, I lift weights and, you know, do typical stuff in the gym too, but for moving my body. But I've gotten a little bit more into this past summer, like Tai Chi practice. And that's something that's also been dabbled around a little bit. I've had good experiences with it. And then, probably say those things in particular. And then gotten back into reading over the course of the pandemic. Like reading for leisure. Now, typically I read voraciously scientific journals and stuff like that. But reading now How to Change Your Mind by Michael Pollan, which is on the history of psychedelics and research. So it's kind of interesting stuff. So I like his documentaries, and lady friend that I'm dating now, who's also brought to the person that got me back into Tai Chi, We both really enjoy his, he has documentaries and she has his books. So yeah.
Awesome.
Cool. Very You're cool. the first guest to say Tai Chi, I think. So that's awesome.
Yeah. 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 I mean, in terms of a meditative and active practice, like it's a pretty good one. Something you can do. Now that I'm moving more towards the, you know, lifespan fitness stage of my life, you know, I got to start investing in things I can do, you know, long-term forever. So that's a good one.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you so, so much for coming on, Dr. Severin. It was awesome to talk to you.
Likewise. Well, thank you guys for having me. You know, I'm excited to see this one get out there and I'm excited to see this podcast grow and I'll see you in class tomorrow.
Thank you. Have a good night.
All right. Take care, guys.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Move Your Brain, Move Your Body podcast. Join in every week as we release new episodes.
Subscribe or leave us a rating at Apple Podcasts. If you have questions or topics to cover, please email moveyourbb@gmail.com or follow us on Instagram @moveyourbb.